This quest may be attempted by the weak with as much hope as the strong. Yet such is oft the course of deeds that move the wheels of the world. Small hands do them because they must, while the eyes of the great are elsewhere.
Clifford, we're back again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we split this episode up in two because the second half that we're doing here, like, okay, we went through all the history and that's fun. Like, that's a fun hobby that I like, you know? But, like, the second part, this is the meat of the chapter. This is, like, the meat of the book. These are, like, the conversations that's, like, this is what makes this a great classic.
Mm-hmm.
And so to just try to do that at the end of, like, a super long episode, I just thought it would be an injustice. So, mm-hmm. Tolkien wins here, and we have to do two parts.
Part one, I think, rounded out everything that we know so far. It was The Hobbit, which we've gone through, book one of Lord of the Rings, which Frodo told, and then all this other stuff. Elrond gave us a bunch of history, and then Gandalf said what he's been up to, which, you know, kind of contains all these other references and secrets that we had heretofore been unaware of. But now they have to look to the present and the future.
Right. So we know this ring's the ring. We know all the history. What are we going to do with it? You want to take that first big passage?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty interesting, so.
Well, the tale is now told from first to last. Here we all are, and here is the ring. But we have not yet come any nearer to our purpose. What shall we do with it? There was a silence. At last, Elrond spoke. This is grievous news concerning Saruman, he said. For we trusted him, and he is deep into all our counsels. It is perilous to study too deeply the arts of the enemy, for good or for ill. But such falls and betrayals, alas, have happened before. Of the tales that we have heard this day, the tale of Frodo was most strange to me. I have known few hobbits, save Bilbo here, and it seems to me that he is perhaps not so alone and singular as I had thought him. The world has changed much since I last was on the westward roads. The Barrow-wights we know by many names, and of the old forest many tales have been told. All that now remains is but an outlier of its northern march. Time was when a squirrel could go from tree to tree, from what is now the Shire to Dunland west of Isengard. In those lands I journeyed once, and many things strange and wild I knew. But I had forgotten Bombadil, if indeed this is still the same that walked the woods and hills long ago. And even then was older than old. That was not then his name. Eärwain Ben-Adar we called him, oldest and fatherless. But many another name he has since been given by other folk, Thorn by the dwarves, Orald by the northern men's, and other names beside. He is a strange creature, but maybe I should have summoned him to our council. He would not have come, said Gandalf. Could we not still send messages to him and obtain his help, asked Arrestor. It seems that he has a power even over the ring. No, I should not put it so, said Gandalf. Say rather that the ring has no power over him. He is his own master, but he cannot alter the ring itself, nor break its power over others. And now he is withdrawn into a little land, within bounds that he has set, though none can see them, waiting perhaps for a change of days, and he will not step beyond them. But within those bounds nothing seems to dismay him, said Arrestor. Would he not take the ring and keep it there, forever harmless? No, said Gandalf, not willingly. He might do so, if all the free folk of the world begged him, but he would not understand the need, and if he were given the ring, he would soon forget it, or most likely throw it away. Such things have no hold on his mind. He would be a most unsafe guardian, and that alone is answer enough.
All right, so Bombadil's back, in conversation at least.
And he comes back almost anecdotally because Elrond is like, yeah, I kind of forgot about that guy. He was a little bit weird, but pretty interesting.
Elrond, who remembers everything, forgot Tom right. Bombadil. But so as we had gone over in the Bombadil chapters, it's pretty clear that Tom is, well, we had said he was probably like a pre-fall mm-hmm. figure and everything, and he's connected to like unbound nature, you know, and so like history and the ring is part of history, doesn't have any sort of right. effect on him. So that seems attractive, like maybe he would be a good keeper of the ring, you mm-hmm. know. But Gandalf straight up saying like, no, he probably wouldn't, you know, if everybody begged him, he'd take it, but then he'd just forget about it and throw it out, you know.
Right.
Like it just wouldn't matter. Like it has so little effect on him that he doesn't care about it.
Right.
What do you think that they're kind of getting at for bringing him up? Because they brought him up, I mean, like, that was a decent chunk that you just read, and it's all about Bombadil. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're clearly impressed that it had no power over him. That's an asset here, because they already know that the ring sways people. It makes them vengeful, it makes them power hungry. It's a really dangerous thing to have around. So if they can give it to someone who's not affected by it at all, it seems like a pretty good option, right?
Right.
And Bombadil's got this, you know, like his cross between Garden of Eden and Alice's Wonderland type thing going on, where they're like, well, maybe we can just hide it in this, like, time warp of a forest, and it can stay there.
So I think what they're getting at here, also based off what I was reading, other people think this too. Bombadil, basically, he's probably, like, a pacifist kind of character, mm-hmm. you know, like he's not going to get involved in war and everything. Mm-hmm. And like, hey, they respect that. He's like an honorable person and everything, mm-hmm. but he's the one that stays like on the margin of any sort mm-hmm. of conflict. But at the same time, what we're having right now is basically a war council.
Mm-hmm.
They have to fight evil and that's unavoidable.
Yeah.
And basically this is, to quote Fleming Rutledge again, this is Tolkien's way of saying that no one can afford to be oblivious when the enemy is at the gates.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Tom Bombadil, we love you, but your pacifism won't be enough in this situation.
Right.
This is the time to act. This is the time to fight. We can't just throw this thing away and just kind of duck our heads in the sand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which this is why the end of this chapter is so cool, because it's like, hey, this is the time. Like, I guess we should keep going, but it's like everybody's gonna step up here, and it's awesome. This is what makes this chapter so
mm-hmm.
great.
Mm-hmm. but Glorfindel chimes in. But in any case, to send the ring to him would only postpone the day of evil. He is far away. We could not now take it back to him, unguessed, unmarked by any spy. And even if we could, soon or late, the Lord of the Rings would learn of its hiding place and would bend all his power towards it. Could that power be defied by Bombadil alone? I think not. I think that in the end, if all else is conquered, Bombadil will fall, last as he was first, and then night will come.
Yeah, so Glorfindel's saying, like, all right, Bombadil couldn't even last. But then Elrond even confirms, too. He's like, here in Rivendell, I don't have the strength to hold back Mordor forever either. No mm-hmm. elf kingdom does. And yes, Tom doesn't either.
And Galdor adds, I know little of Iarwen, save the name. But Glorfindel, I think, is right. Power to defy our enemy is not in him, unless such power is in the earth itself. And yet we see that Sauron can torture and destroy the very hills. What power still remains lies with us, here in Imladris, or with Curdan at the Havens, or in Lorien. But they have the strength. Have we here the strength to withstand the enemy? The coming of Sauron at the last, when all else is overthrown?
Yeah, and Elrond straight up says no.
So that's a double whammy. That's one, Bombadil, as we discussed, is kind of some distillation of nature. And Sauron is like conquering the earth itself, not just the players, the creatures of the earth. He's conquering the actual earth. So right, it would seem that Bombadil doesn't have enough strength.
Yeah, so let's go to other options here. Glorfindel says, okay, Saruman was lying to us that the ring fell into the Great Sea and everything, mm-hmm. but why not just take his lead and throw the ring in the sea where it'll be safe, you know, and then nobody will ever find it again.
Right.
And Gandalf shoots him down because he says, well, I don't actually think it'll be safe forever. You know, there's evil things there. Many things are in the deep waters and seas and lands can change and everything. So, like, it probably would be found eventually.
Yeah, we have to remember the ring sat at the bottom of, I mean, albeit a river and not a sea, but was buried for a long time and then was found.
Yeah. And then Gandalf has this just impressive lines here where he just says, and it is not our part here to take thought only for a season, for a few lives of men, or for the passing age of the world. We should seek a final end of this menace, even if we do not hope to make one. Which Glador then says, yeah, I mean, it kind of seems perilous to go west with it again, because that's what Sauron would expect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Gladder keeps going on to say, only the waning might of Gondor stands now between him and the march, and a march in power along the coast into the north. And if he comes, assailing the White Towers and the Havens, hereafter the elves may have no escape from the lengthening shadows of Middle-earth. Long yet will that march be delayed, said Boromir. Gondor wanes, you say, but Gondor stands, and even if at the end of its strength, it is still very strong. And yet its vigilance no longer can keep back the Nine, said Glador, and other roads he may find that Gondor does not guard. Then, said Esther, there are but two courses, as Glorfindel already declared, to hide the ring forever, or to unmake it. Both are beyond our power. Who can read this riddle for us? None here can do so, said Elrond gravely. At least none can foretell what will come to pass, if we take this road or that. But it seems to me now clear that which is the road we must take. The westward road seems easiest. Therefore, it must be shunned. It will be watched. Too often the elves have fled that way. Now at this last time, we take a hard road, a road unforeseen. There lies our hope, if it be hope. To walk into peril, to Mordor. We must send the ring to the fire.
Epic.
Oh, yeah. That's good. Getting goosebumps? Mm-hmm. I hope you're getting goosebumps. Hopefully.
Yeah, so in the course of, what, maybe 10 paragraphs or something, they were like, okay, there's fight, flight, and destruction, maybe. And they ran through all their options.
And it was the lesser characters that kind of ran through the options, too. It was like Gladder and Esther, who are like the least relevant guys here, maybe not least important, but least relevant. And it's
one thing we skipped over that I wanted to make sure we touched was there was the suggestion, oh well, maybe we could send it to Valinor, we could send it across the sea and just get it out of here, so then it, you know, it's in the realm of the gods, or at least the elves who live across the way. And but Elrond says, but Gandalf has revealed to us that we cannot destroy it by any craft that we here possess, and they who dwell beyond the sea would not receive it. For good or ill, it belongs to Middle-earth, and it is for us who still dwell here to deal with it. So that's important, I think, just to this is a big deal, and we got to do something with it. And also, it is very specifically our problem to deal with. This is not some other person's problem that fell into our lap. It's our problem.
Well, I mean, most of these characters did not start the problem.
That's true.
They're saying, hey, no, this is ours to figure out. We're not pushing this off. We're not going to ask anybody else for help. This is our time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yes. Oh, this is all I ever wanted in a story. It's just like, yeah, I'll get pumped off that. That's inspiring. Like, this is what I'm all about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, the easy way must be shunned. Too often have the elves chosen that way. We're not doing that this time. We're going to do something unexpected. We're taking the hardest road we can. And even if we don't have any hope in this, we're going to try it, and we're going to do it, and we're going to make a final end.
Right, right.
Which, all of that, just awesome. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Again, we had said the fruitless victory is kind of like a reminiscence of, like, a World War One line.
Mm-hmm.
Here they're kind of, this might be like a reference to kind of like 1938, 1939 times, because at that point they're doing appeasement with Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Like Hitler's just walking into places all around Germany, just like lengthening his grasp and control.
Right.
And all these European countries, the guys in power, they had been soldiers in World War One, so they didn't want to see another war. So they're just like, let's just get along with the guy and settle.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And so, like, the most famous thing of all was the British Prime Minister before Churchill was Neville Chamberlain, and he makes a deal with Hitler, and, like, the famous quote that comes out of it is, like, we have peace for our time and everything, you know? Like, we peace for our time, but it's like, no, that's the opposite of what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Gandalf and Elrond are just like, no, this is on us, this is the time, we're gonna go make a real peace, we're not just gonna have, like, a semi-peace or, like, you know, get peace for a couple decades by time, like what Chamberlain was doing. It's like, no, this is it.
We're going
after this. We're going to strike this in, like, the jugular, basically.
Right. And they seem like they understand they can make this thing disappear for thousands of years, but it's not good enough. They need to make it gone forever.
Well, I mean, it has been disappeared for 1,000 years, and now they're in, like, the darkest point where they've ever been. From what we're gathering, from like the whole first half of this chapter that we did, it's like, yeah, it's rough.
Mm-hmm. You know,
like they're on the cusp of like a great evil, or I don't know, big things to come, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Silence fell again. Frodo, even in that fair house, looking out upon a sunlit valley filled with noise of clear waters, felt a dead darkness in his heart. Boromir stirred, and Frodo looked at him. He was fingering his great horn and frowning. At length he spoke. "I do not understand all this," he said. "Saruman is a traitor. But did he not have a glimpse of wisdom? Why do you speak ever of hiding and destroying? Should we not think that the great ring has come into our hands to serve us in the very hour of need? Wielding it, the free lords of the free may surely defeat the enemy. That is what he most fears, I deem. The men of Gondor are valiant, and they will never submit, but they may be beaten down. Valor needs first strength, and then a weapon. Let the ring be your weapon, if it has such a power as you say. Take it and go forth to victory." To which Elrond replies, "Alas, no. We cannot use the ruling ring. That we now know too well. It belongs to Sauron and was made by him alone, and is altogether evil. Its strength, Boromir, is too great for anyone to wield at will, save only those who have already a great power of their own. But for them it holds an even deadlier peril. The very desire of it corrupts the heart. Consider Saruman. If any of the wise should with this ring overthrow the Lord of Mordor, using his own arts, he would then set himself on Sauron's throne, and yet another Dark Lord would appear. And that is another reason why the ring should be destroyed. As long as it is in the world, it will be a danger even to the wise. For nothing is evil in the beginning. Even Sauron was not so. I fear to take the ring to hide it. I will not take the ring to wield it." "Nor I," said Gandalf.
All right, so that's pretty big.
That affirms some of what we've discussed before. Like, the very desire for the ring corrupts the heart. We talked quite a bit about that, speculating that might be the case. And Elrond vindicates that now.
Right. So just to be clear, Boromir had said, like, well, why don't we use the ring for good? You know, this is a great, powerful weapon. Let's just use it rightly. Again, Boromir's perspective, he's been basically in the equivalent of the trenches. So, like, he's been as on the front lines as you can, and that's all he's focused on is just getting rid of this enemy and, like, routing him, basically. You know, like, getting back to what's normal and, like, Gondor back to prosperity. And so, from that point of view, hey, here's a big weapon that can help us. I mean, it's at least a noble thing to ask, like, hey, can we use this to go fight the bad guys?
Right. But at the end of the day, he's making the same mistake that Saruman made, where he's saying, well, we're good. We're strong. We can resist its evil forces and we can use it, which is exactly the same thought that Saruman had. And at the end of the day, that the lack of humility, like the unwillingness to acknowledge that this thing is stronger than you or that you don't fully understand what's going on, plays into the danger of it.
Right. And so luckily Boromir, this is his first thought of using it. Whereas Saruman, when we met him, from what Gandalf was telling us, Saruman's been thinking about this idea for like years.
Right.
So like he's fully like he's just way in deep, like so committed to doing it. Whereas Boromir, you can have good influences like Elrond and Gandalf right there to say, no, we can't do that. You know, you just heard the story about Saruman. Mm-hmm. He's our example. We can't be like this. If we even think about using it, that's insidious. Mm-hmm. Like this is a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. And then really important thing here, I feel like this plays a bigger role in the entire Lord of the Rings than we might give it credit for. Elrond just throws out here, for nothing is evil in the beginning. Even Sauron was not so. He's kind of monologuing about why we shouldn't take the ring, but that's a big statement to make, right?
We've actually already seen that in the music of the Ainur. Like, even Melkor was, like, kind of a good guy originally.
Right. I guess this plays it out, though, in the context of Middle-earth with all of this and evil already set up.
Yep, for sure.
Because I agree with the music of the Ainur, your point that everything was harmonious at one point in time. But throughout the Silmarillion, we had a very, like, old-school mythology, good guys, bad guys, doing battle, right?
Yeah. Even
in Lord of the Rings, things have gotten a little more nuanced, but there's very clear sides.
Well, see, I mean, all this stuff, it's like, I mean, yeah, they're fighting evil, which that's not at all like a new idea throughout our history or throughout their history and everything. But it's still funny that we talked about this in chapter 2, that the ring's a pretty modern idea. Like, absolute power corrupts absolutely is what we were kind of saying.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very modern concept. You didn't see that really... you didn't think about that until the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Nobody was thinking about that. And then you didn't know it for sure until you saw it in the 20th century with all the evils of the world wars, mm-hmm. basically. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we had already established in the second chapter that rings immensely powerful in any hands. It's also dangerous and ultimately fatal to all its possessors. There are no right hands for it. And then also, it simply cannot be left unused or put aside. Like, we've already established that in Chapter 2, mm-hmm. reaffirmed right here, you know?
But I guess that's, at the end of the day, that's a very benevolent worldview from Elrond, that nothing is evil in the beginning. Like, all evil you see was basically corrupted by evil, right. or however you want to describe it.
Well, we've seen that too in not only the music of the Ainur, but like the Ringwraiths are shadows. You know, like shadows are the absence of good. Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't know, we're kind of tying it together and seeing how this works.
Yeah, yeah.
Seeing how Tolkien thinks it works, mm-hmm. and stuff. Well, let's keep going though.
Okay.
So Boromir goes on to say, well, then it sounds like Gondor has to keep holding back Mordor without the ring. But if the sword that was broken could come, that would really help.
Here, I feel like he's playing he's real humble, sort of another humble cowboy character, where he's like, well, I did my best. And, you know, if you want to give me this special sword or this special ring, I would appreciate it. But I'll go back to fighting my fight if you don't want to give me either one of them.
I mean, possibly, but I think it's more, if you look from his mindset, it's just like, okay, these really smart, wise guys are telling me, yeah, no, you can't use the ring. So that's out. So again, single-minded focus. I got to protect my homeland.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so that option's out. So I was, you know, I came here to find answers, and like the sword that was broken, I kept hearing about mm-hmm. that. I see the sword that was broken. This Aragorn guy might be able to help. I'm just trying to assess my people. Like, we need help. I guess Aragorn could come help.
Yeah, but, you know,
like, it's a consolation prize, because this ring's not going to work out, apparently. Wait, like, I'm just going to take their word for
right.
it.
Right. With Boromir, though, there's always time for a little microaggression. Mayhap the sword that was broken may still stem the tide, if the hand that wields it has inherited not an heirloom only, but the sinews of the kings of men. Which is, you know, like, yeah, that's a lot of lingo right there, but that's a serious dig. Yeah. It's like, oh, Aragorn, you know, did you just, like, find this thing under your pillow one day? Or are you actually one of the real descendants of the Numenoreans?
Yeah. Are you man enough to use that yeah. sword?
Which is, yeah, so Aragorn, I think, stays above the fray a little bit and says, who can tell? But we will put it to the test one day.
Right. All right, but they still are discussing options as a whole, though, right? And so Gloin goes on to say the dwarf rings would help too, but they were lost. And then Gloin asks about the three elven rings as well.
The elves returned no answer. Did you not hear me, Gloin? Said Elrond. The three were not made by Sauron, nor did he ever touch them. But of them it is not permitted to speak. So much only in this hour of doubt I may now say. They are not idle, but they were not made as weapons of war or conquest. That is not their power. Those who made them did not desire strength or domination or hoarded wealth, but understanding, making, and healing. To preserve all things unstained. These things the elves of Middle-earth have in some measure gained, though with sorrow. But all that has been wrought by those who wield the three will turn to their undoing, and their minds and hearts will become revealed to Sauron if he regains the one. It would be better if the three had never been. That is his purpose. But what then would happen if the ruling ring were destroyed, as you counsel? Asked Gloin. We know not for certain, answered Elrond sadly. Some hope that the three rings, which Sauron has never touched, would then become free, and the rulers might heal the hurts of the world that he has wrought. But maybe, when the one has gone, the three will fail, and many fair things will fade and be forgotten. That is my belief. Yet all the elves are willing to endure this chance, said Glorfindel, if by it the power of Sauron may be broken, and the fear of his dominion be taken away forever. Thus we return once more to the destroying of the ring, said Aristur.
Oh, now that is noble. Holy crap.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big chunk to break up, too.
Mm-hmm. All
right, so we have to talk about that. So when the one fails, the three will probably fail, too, and many fair things will vanish. Because, like, that's what Elrond was saying. So again, like, these rings of power, he was saying they didn't make them for desire of strength or domination or hoarding wealth. Mm-hmm. They made them for making and healing and preserving all things unstained.
Mm-hmm.
They're continuing, basically, the beauty of their lands, mm-hmm. right? But if the one ring's destroyed, these three rings will probably fail too.
Mm.
But what Glorfindel said there, the elves are willing to take that chance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which, just, that's extremely noble.
Yeah.
Extremely noble.
Yeah.
It's also sad, though. And it's beautiful, too.
Right.
To go back to the music of Iluvatar, I remember, like, when they said that third theme of Iluvatar, uh-huh. that one was, it was super beautiful, but its beauty chiefly came from its sadness. Mm-hmm. I don't know, somehow this just kind of reminds me of that, too.
Yeah.
For final victory, the elves are willing to give up everything that they hold dear.
This strikes this melancholy chord for me that we see, say, when we see the elves, like, kind of walking through the woods off to the Grey Havens to sail across the sea. Like, they're fading from the world, and there's something about this, like, I mentioned this a few times before. Tolkien, in the background of this story, it's not even the main storyline, or even the second primary storyline, maybe, but there's this, like, changing, irrevocable changing of the world. Like, time passing intensely, and the elves are part of that. Like, they're immortal, and yet they're moving with the changing of the world. And it's, yeah, it's somehow, like, really very, very, like, powerful and sad.
Well, and this is explicitly where it said. Like, we picked up that feeling with Gildor and, you know, in, like, Woody End, like, when Sam and Pippin and Frodo were just starting mm-hmm. out. But now it's like, yeah, here it explicitly is. Sauron and Glorfindel are both saying it. It's like, this is going to be the last hurrah of the elves, most likely. Our time's done.
Mm-hmm.
But we could just have, like, a draw. But instead, we're going to go for broke and help everybody else out for, like, a final victory. Mm-hmm. Like, we could just tie and just leave.
Stalemate?
Yeah, like a stalemate. But mm-hmm. no, we're not doing that.
Right.
So, which is awesome. Gandalf said it before. It's like, this is our problem. We're not going to push our problems off on anybody mm-hmm. else. We're standing up here and we're going to do it. And the elves really don't even have to, mm-hmm. but they're gonna.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just sweet. These are the kind of things that make you, like, love these books. When you hear stuff like that and you reflect on it and you appreciate that.
Right. And I think this whole concept of the elves fading from the world, and specifically this sacrifice, for me, I kind of emphasizes Tolkien's, like, romantic mindset. Like, I kind of said in the last section, or maybe a little while back, about Tolkien having this sort of, like, romanticized view of certain aspects of mythology. Here,
right.
He's got, like, he's ardently driving home the point that, like, the world was once more beautiful and is constantly becoming less beautiful. Or rather, there's, like, a sense of fallen beauty in our current world, and it's our responsibility as slightly corrupted creatures to strive for that beauty that once was.
I think all the mythology he would have studied, and, like, he was a romantic with all his studies and of that kind. But I think here, too, just as equally, I'd say, this is where his own life is playing into it. Like, he saw people, like, before World War II trying to appease Hitler and, you know, just push off the inevitable. He saw in his own lifetime, like, no, there's great evil, has to be confronted. We have to stop it in mm-hmm. our time. Like, we don't let other people solve this. Like, mm-hmm. we got to step mm-hmm. up. Like, that's what he's in favor of. That's what he did. Yeah, one last quote to finish it off. Rutledge again. We have all seen meetings where the contribution of one person marks a turning point and begins to shape a resolution. Sometimes such summons establish a reality that was inchoate until it was spoken. We will remember Glorfindel's voice in this exchange and the sacrifice that the elves of Rivendell are making. Their selfless leadership sets a tone for all that will come after. The mood of the council is gradually swayed in this direction by Gandalf, Elrond, and Glorfindel. So, we know that this ring now has to be destroyed, but who's going to do it?
To quote directly, "Thus we return once more to the destroying of the ring," said Arrestor, "and yet we come no nearer. What strength have we for finding of the fire in which it was made? That is the path of despair. Of folly, I would say, if the long wisdom of Elrond did not forbid me." "Despair or folly," said Gandalf. "It is not despair, for despair is only for those who see the end beyond all doubt. We do not. It is wisdom to recognize necessity when all other courses have been weighed, though as folly it may appear to those who cling to false hope. Well, let folly be our cloak, a veil before the eyes of the enemy, for he is very wise and weighs all things to a nicety in the scales of his malice. But the only measure that he knows is desire, desire for power, and so he judges all hearts. Into this heart the thought will not enter that any will refuse it, that having the ring we may seek to destroy it. If we seek this, we shall put him out of reckoning. At least for a while, said Elrond. The road must be trod, but it will be very hard, and neither strength nor wisdom will carry us far upon it. This quest may be attempted by the weak with as much hope as the strong. Yet such is oft the course of deeds that move the wheels of the world. Small hands do them because they must, while the eyes of the great are elsewhere.
All right, another big quote. Big section.
Yes. I mean, a few things here. Gandalf, with a nice do not despair reassurance.
Of course.
Like, no, we stand strong. Yeah. We don't know what's going to happen, and that's why we do not despair.
Also interesting that the enemy doesn't expect him to destroy the ring.
Like, right. No, that's not really a concept. That's critical. This is the least expected option, because Sauron desires the ring so badly. It's the only thing he can think about, and therefore it's the only thing he could expect his enemies to do is also to desire the ring. He knows that it's desirable. So the thought to destroy something so desirable, like to be able to basically resist it, reject it, and want to destroy it, is the most out of left field thing that could happen here.
Foreign concept.
Right. And so therefore, they decide it's the best option to go against Sauron.
Elrond's quote too, he brings it back to we had said in the episode before, like, you've been called, but I didn't call you. You know, who called you? It's the higher power, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, like, you're feeling that in his quote here, where he's just saying, like, all right, now's the time for the weak to step up with as much hope as the strong. Yet it is oft the course of deeds that move the wheels of the world. Small hands do them because they must, while the eyes of the great are elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So getting back to that topic of, well, is this just, like, predestined to happen? Like, is this what's meant to happen? Which it kind of sounds like it is. Like, all of Elrond's language and, like, the really crucial parts, not besides where he's just, like, dialoguing about, like, retelling what happened in history. Like, it sounds like, yes, this stuff's meant to happen. Like, we're at a time of great deeds, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't ordered by me or ordained by Gandalf or anybody. Like, this is... And it wasn't by Sauron. There's something else that's guiding us here.
Mm-hmm.
You get that feeling. We've talked about this, too. I think probably in that Frodo and Gandalf conversation chapter about at Bag End, like... Well, if this is meant to happen, do they really have a choice in what's going to happen? And Tolkien, you know, that's kind of like the fun of reading this book and going through it. As you read through it, it's kind of hard to determine, like, yeah, well, right here in this quote, it sounds like Elrond saying, hey, this is predestined to happen. But in other times, it sounds like, and we'll see, like, hey, I think this guy just chose to do this, you know? And so Tolkien, we don't quite know which he's believing in, or if he has a camp on that, you know, like if he actually takes sides on that. And on the contrary, he wants us to be carried along in the midst of seeming contradiction by the momentum of the plot. So he literally does like that the plot's just like it's a pendulum swinging from one side to the other. Again, based on those Elrond lines, like, yet such is oft the course of the deeds that move the wheels of the world. Small hands do them because they must, while the eyes of the great are elsewhere. Again, we can compare to biblical verses again, because Fleming Rutledge is queen of bringing this up. The first letter of the Corinthians from St. Paul. Consider your call, brethren. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong.
Mm.
Let me just read Elrond's quote one more time. The road must be trod, but it will be very hard, and neither strength nor wisdom will carry us upon it. This quest may be attempted by the weak with as much hope as the strong. Yet, such is oft the course of deeds that moves the wheels of the world. Small hands do them because they must, while the eyes of the great are elsewhere. All right, so what do you make of that first? I've been talking.
I mean, well, for Elrond's thing, there's some distinct foreshadowing to keep in mind. Small hands do them because they must. But more broadly, I mean, I think for me it ties into a few different things. One, there's like the, why are there things in the world that are not all, like, why is everything not beautiful and strong and perfect and all that? And this is a good explanation of, like, why there's difference in the first place. Why is there weakness? Because it, you know, it has relevance to strength. Why is there foolishness? Because it contrasts with wisdom.
Or I think it's more so like, hey, if you relate it to, like, the New Testament, God's not picking the best candidates. He's not picking the strongest candidates. He's taking and molding, like, you know, using whatever he can. And in lots of cases, it's like the marginal or weak people mm-hmm. in the society. But even there, it's like, hey, they're going to be good enough to accomplish this purpose. And that's what Elrond's saying here, too, is what I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, well, all of it is sort of like an underdog, like champion of the underdog situation.
Which, that's also a shout-out, because we've already heard the Wheels of the World quote has come up before when we were talking about Beren and Lúthien, because they were the underdogs going into Angband to steal the Silmaril. So that this kind of idea of underdogs, you know, the weak doing what the strong should be doing, but they're mm-hmm. elsewhere, that goes all the way back to his Beren and Lúthien stories from, like, the 19-teens when he was writing them, you know.
Cool.
Which is cool, again.
Very. I have to imagine you can maybe jump in about some more specific Tolkien history, but this has got to, like, appeal. It's like this kind of humanist impulse that he's showing, where, as we've said before, he's wary of industrialization and, like, the changing of the world around him, in addition to the death and destruction that is World War One and World War Two. And he sees, like, the, I don't know, like, the noble deeds of the individual being lost in all of this chaos, basically.
Well, see, maybe it was lost to society, but he fought in World War One, and he was fighting alongside average Joes, you know, and so, like,
right.
he recognizes
and they,
their
so accomplishment. They are the individuals yes. that yeah. made, they're, like, grinding the gears of war.
Right.
You know, they're, it's not like the war was won by the politicians.
He saw small, valiant actions from all the people around him, and that's probably what's inspiring it here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so then at this point, after all of this talk, Bilbo stands up and he offers to take the ring again. And everybody shows him, like, a lot of decency and respect, but Gandalf basically says, thanks for the offer, Bilbo, but you're too old and the ring's passed on. Why don't you just finish your book and get ready to write a sequel for when they come back?
Mm-hmm.
And Bilbo's wondering, well, who's they? And Gandalf says, well, the messengers who are going to be sent with the ring.
Exactly. And who are they to be? That seems to me what this council has to decide, and all that it has to decide. Elves may thrive on speech alone, and dwarves endure great weariness, but I am only an old hobbit, and I miss my meal at noon. Can't you think of some names now, or put it off till after dinner?
No one answered. The noon bell rang. Still no one spoke. Frodo glanced at all the faces, but they were not turned to him. All the council sat with downcast eyes, as if in deep thought. A great dread fell on him, as if he was waiting for the pronouncement of some doom that he had long foreseen and vainly hoped might, after all, never be spoken. Overwhelmingly longing to rest and remain at peace by Bilbo's side in Rivendell filled all his heart. At last, with an effort, he spoke, and wondered to hear his own words, as if some other will was using his small voice. I will take the ring, he said, though I do not know the way. Elrond raised his eyes and looked at him, and Frodo felt his heart pierced by a sudden keenness of the glance. If I understand aright all that I have heard, he said, I think that this task is appointed for you, Frodo, and that if you do not find a way, no one will. This is the hour of the Shire folk, when they arise from their quiet fields to shake the towers and councils of the great. Who of all the wise could have foreseen it? Or, if they are wise, why should they expect to know it until the hour has struck? But it is a heavy burden, so heavy that none could lay it on another. I do not lay it on you, but if you take it freely, I will say that your choice is right. And though all the mighty elf friends of old, Hador and Húrin and Túrin and Beren himself, were assembled together, your seat should be among them.
But you won't send him off alone, surely, master, cried Sam, unable to contain himself any longer, and jumping up from the corner where he had been quietly sitting on the floor.
No, indeed, said Elrond, turning to him with a smile. You at least shall go with him. It is hardly possible to separate you from him, even when he is summoned to a secret council, and you are not.
Sam sat down, blushing and muttering. A nice pickle we have landed ourselves in, Mr. Frodo, he said, shaking his head.
Pretty good ending. Pretty good ending there.
Mm-hmm.
But also big ending. A lot of stuff happened in...
Yeah.
Like the wrap up, the quick page wrap up to the 30 page chapter.
Right. I felt like this chapter was kind of like it was all slowly going downhill and it really started picking up speed until
right.
the end. I have to say, well, two funny things here as a side note. One, all of this has happened before lunch. Like,
the
noon bell just rang.
Yeah.
So they must have been so efficient to have covered all of The Hobbit and all of Book One before the noon bell rings for lunch.
Oh, yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah.
I mean, I don't see any other way around it. And then second, you know, there's been all this talking and everyone's saying, well, you know, here's where I come from and here's what I, what's been going on with me and here's what I think. And then Frodo just says, he says, you know, barely 10 words. I will take the ring, right, though I do not know the way. And to which Elrond responds, like, given everything that I've heard, that's a great answer.
Well, I, what you're right, when Frodo speaks, it's super simple. So we've heard, it probably didn't come across in these episodes because we had to summarize everything, but we hear all these clash of linguistic styles and everything, but then all of a sudden, right at the end, the hobbits just drop in and they speak simply and plainly, and they're direct and they're humble, and then, you know, that reflects in exactly what they're saying too. Silence fell on everybody. Silence comes up like 3 times here, and like they're downcast, like they don't want to look up because it's like, all right, don't call on me to take this thing, right? I mean, I don't know. That's kind of what I interpret it being. The pronouncement of some doom that he had long foreseen and vainly hoped might, after all, never be spoken. You know, so Frodo's like looking around and it's just like, I don't know. I've kind of felt this, probably this call, at least for a while now. And I hoped I wouldn't have to do this, but it seems like I might have to do this. And, you know, again, like the quote, at last, with an effort, he spoke and wondered to hear his own words as if some other will was using his small voice. This isn't just Frodo coming up here and just saying this is going to be a good idea. Like, he's getting strength to do this from another source. But he knows and he wants to do this himself. So this brings up, again, like, we just hinted on it before, but now maybe this is a more proper place to talk about it. Elrond's language was all destiny was leading up to this, right? Whereas now we see Frodo, yeah, something's clearly influencing him, but he's freely choosing to do this here. Like, Elrond makes sure, he's just like, if you are going to freely take this, yeah, I do think that's, from everything I've heard, that sounds like a good idea. So it's a so Frodo, this is free will. He's freely accepting to do this too. And so again, like the seesaw of like predestination or free will, here they're almost kind of like meeting. This is destiny and Frodo's free will are like identical. Like, it leads up to this moment where they're just in completely synced up. Yeah, Frodo is appointed for a great trial. It is clear that he does not have the strength within himself to accept the appointment, but some other will is working in him. Christian theology would say this is the action of the Holy Spirit arming him for some fearsome task.
But, I mean, I guess it is a tricky thing to wrap your head around, that he feels both like possessed by something else and that he is making this decision freely.
Yeah, it's weird, but it's just, I guess at like these really great moments, those things just, they do work in tandem. Like, I mean, and it's not like they have to, but they just do, you know, and like, that's just the best option. The other thing that the books were bringing up, this, I will take the ring, though I do not know the way. This sounds a lot like Mary at the Annunciation. So this is when, at the beginning of the Gospels, in Luke's Gospel specifically, the angel Gabriel comes to Mary and is like, hey, Mary, you're chosen by God, blessed among women, to bear the Savior of the world. And then her answer is, let it be done to me according to your word. So in this situation in Lord of the Rings, and in Mary's situation in real life, like, the salvation of the whole world depends on this choice, and she freely accepts it. Like, she didn't have to, but she does. And just like Frodo here, it's like, he doesn't have to, but he does. Now, they don't have to, but I do kind of wonder, like, well, what if they didn't?
right.
Which is exactly where the destiny part comes in, like, this is meant to happen. But, I mean, it's clear that they're not coerced into doing anything. Like, they just choose it.
Right.
There's a good quote here. Peter Crave talked about this in his Philosophy of Tolkien book. This was pretty good, helpful in this section. Neither Tolkien nor St. Luke tells us what invisible force in the soul motivated this visible choice, but there are only two possibilities, pride and humility. When we hear, I will take the ring, we may think we hear pride, but when we hear, though I do not know the way, we know we hear humility. Tolkien kept explicit religion out of Lord of the Rings, but here is a powerful example of implicit religion. No one but an arrogant fool could do what Frodo did without throwing an anchor out into the deep of supernatural grace. Thoughts?
It's dense. I mean, I guess how can we, if we go off that, how do we know that Frodo's not an arrogant fool doing this?
Because like Boromir and Saruman, they might wield the ring and say, like, yeah, I'm strong enough to resist this. Whereas Frodo, when he says, I don't know the way, you know, like, he's clearly, like, he's not at all trying to claim, like, he's going to be powerful enough to just master this thing himself and do the right thing. I don't know. That seems like a clear sign to me, like, all right, I don't know the way, so I'm going to need help. You know, like, I'll do it, but I need help, right? Mm-hmm. Which, I think that's a sign of humility.
Okay.
So, going on to Mary's consent to carry the savior of the world in her womb and then eventually be his mother versus Frodo. He's consenting to actually carry the destroyer of the world, like this ring. Like, this is the fate of the world, and it's basically death, almost, you know? And so it's like, so Mary gave life to life, and Frodo's going to give death to death.
Okay.
So they're both making, like, a fate of the world choice, but one is to, Mary's is kind of, like, in a good way, whereas Frodo's is like, well, it'll be a positive thing, but he's doing a negative thing. Like, he's going to take something evil and destroy it, bear something evil and destroy it.
Right, right. It's a nice comparison, though.
Yeah. Another quote here. We all, like Frodo, carry a quest, a task, our daily duties. So related to your own lives, you know? They come to us, not from us. We are free only to accept or refuse our task and, implicitly, our taskmaster. None of us is a free creator or designer of his own life. None of us lives to himself, and none of us dies to himself. Either God or fate or meaningless chance has laid upon each of us a task, a quest, which we would not have chosen for ourselves. We are all hobbits who love our shire, our security, our creature comforts, whether these are pipeweed, mushrooms, 5 meals a day, and local gossip, or Starbucks coffee, recreational sex, and politics. But some authority not named in Lord of the Rings, but named in the Silmarillion, as we've gone over, has decreed that the quest should interrupt this delightful Epicurean garden and send us on an odyssey. We are plucked out of our hobbit holes and plunked down on the road. This gives us our fundamental choice between obedience and disobedience. And then in this section, he was talking about, like, how life's war. And if life is war, obedience is essential. It is the first virtue of a soldier. All right, I know that one was even denser, but what do you think?
Well, to your point about this is, like, the most inspiring part of the whole thing, because this is, like, Tolkien's, it would seem that this is his intent, is that this is the most resonant portion so far. Like, this is where it's jumping from,
yeah,
here's, like, basically a narrative, a myth, a story, to, like, a call to action.
And obviously we're seeing the story here, but then, yeah, like, I think that what that quote was getting at too, you can relate that to your own life too, which we were saying the same stuff in chapter 2 as well. Like, if you notice, like, there's so many parallels between this the second chapter of book 2 and the second chapter of book 1, you know, where Frodo and Gandalf were explaining it all. I mean, like, it even ends here too with Sam linking up with Frodo again and not to go with
him. So I'll be a downer here. We've made a big deal about how this chapter's all radical and big things happen. This is the crux of the book in some sense. Maybe is it not actually that radical? Like, we've been through this before. Frodo has ponied up and said, like, this is the cross I have to bear already. And here he's, like, kind of resigned to doing it again. And this time it's just more adults are in the room and they've done a lot more talking. But he's already made the hard decision.
I think it goes back to the first chapter of book 2 here that we did, like, 2 episodes ago, where book 1 blew the Hobbit out of proportion, and now book 2 blows book 1 out of proportion. Like, it goes back to that idea. Like, Frodo, you know, because Frodo, he had ideas when he was waking up in Rivendell and talking to Gandalf, like, man, I hope I don't have to go any further. Right. Like, this was already enough adventure for me. So he did actually have, like, an idea, like, maybe I'm done with this. But then he said he felt like that, what was the line? The pronouncement of some doom that he had long foreseen and vainly hoped might, after all, never be spoken. Mm-hmm. So he was hoping that he wouldn't have to come to this point. But it is kind of like it's a second greater, like, significantly greater, like, yes, I will do this. Like, he had to do it already to get it from the Shire to Rivendell, but now he's got to up the ante again. But, once again, Sam also commits to going with him, which is nice. You know, nice finish.
And we're, in some sense, returned to, like, the kind of jovial nature of the plot from the early on in the story and some of what we had in The Hobbit.
Right, yeah.
Like, this is tied us back down to the characters we know and the type of antics we have read so far.
Yeah.
And from the, like, sort of lofty, historic, and archaic review of so much information we've gotten in this chapter.
Now, you know, we're not going to go through, like, the drafts of this chapter, but it took a lot of time, many drafts, to get to this point.
Mm-hmm.
But now we really do actually have our plot. Here yeah. we go. We're finally set. Like, that was what was missing in book one. There's six books to Lord of the Rings here. At the beginning of book two, we now have a plot that can propel us for, like, the next five books.
So are you saying that Tolkien arrived on the plot of the entire series at this point?
Like, it was definitely clearly more fleshed out here.
Okay.
Like, yeah, you're going to go on a quest all the way to Mount Doom to destroy it. Like, that was, like, vaguely in his head, but it was officially formulated here. And this is where he was coming up with all the history and the backstory for it to set it up.
Okay.
That's about all I got, though.
Yeah. Big things.
Yeah, that was a lot. I think we can leave it here, though.
Okay.
All right. Nice job. All right, Clifford, back again for the ending of this. How you doing? Mm-hmm.
Good. How are you?
Pretty good.
Staying safe? Hunkered yeah. down?
Yeah. I'm starting to wear a mask places to the grocery store and stuff.
I've got to get my hands on one.
Well, I just use the one of
bandana
those, like,
or something.
Well, what, that neck thing, you know, like skiers, and I use it for.
Oh
cycling.
Yeah, like a gator.
Yeah, gator. Yeah.
Okay. Smart. Yeah.
Well, actually, it's what I have available. That is,
do you wash it when you get home, though?
No. Do I wash it after bike rides, Clifford?
Apparently, you're supposed to wash it every time you get home.
Apparently. Like it,
I mean, I'm just saying. Apparently, if you don't wash it, it defeats the purpose of wearing it in the first place.
Okay. All right, anyways. Okay, so we finished the episode that just went up that you just listened to was the Council of Elrond Part 2. So this is when they were picking out Frodo to take the ring and everything. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to say on that? Because I remember some stuff.
Go for it.
Okay. So, this is a note. I don't actually remember this. I wrote this note when I was editing it. So, let's see what it says. Clifford was mentioning how even Sauron was good in the beginning. ... Patrick kept talking around this point because he was focused on his notes. How the ring makes good things evil. But Patrick does give examples that we saw in the... Yeah. Okay, so I was talking around this, apparently. But we have already kind of discussed this before, because we've talked about the ring race in evil and how they're, like, kind of like their shadows, because they're the absence of good.
Right.
Like, shadows are just the absence of light.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but what I should have mentioned is this also kind of goes... This goes back to kind of the music of the Ainur and the very beginning of Genesis, where God created the whole world and it was good, just like he mm-hmm. made all the Ainur and they were making the music and it was good until... out of Melkor using his own free will started disrupting music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the idea that Tolkien's getting at. So, wanted to point that out because it was pissing me off when I was editing it. What else is up with you?
Not much to report. In the same boat that I'm sure a lot of folks are in.
Yeah, it's Holy Week.
Mm-hmm.
Probably happy Spy Wednesday or Holy Thursday, depending on...
Are you engaging in any celebrations or activities?
No, I think I'll find live streams of, like, a mass somewhere for those days, but that's about okay. it for me.
And for Easter, too?
Yeah, Easter, there's not... I don't know. I can't see many people.
I know.
I'll get a big-ass pizza Saturday night after okay. whatever vigil mass I watch or something, because I was gluten-free for Lent this year. It really sucked.
Oh, nice. And you held out?
Yeah, pretty good. I broke it on St. Patrick's Day.
Okay.
But that's understandable, because...
It's your patron saint.
I drank a Guinness. And I poured a Guinness into the corned beef that I cooked all day.
Nice.
So, I broke it then, but that was kind of intended. And then other than that, I think I accidentally had, like, a couple beers with gluten, but that's about it.
Okay.
I've had to switch over to cider and wine for these recordings.
Oh, okay.
What about you?
I guess I tried to give up meat for Lent.
Oh, how'd that go?
Decently well. I think slipped a few times, but I've been... Or I should say, I've been trying to be vegan.
Like, permanently or just for Lent?
Well, sort of both. Lent's a good jumping off point.
Okay.
Right. It's a lot easier than I expected it to be.
Dude, gluten was hard.
Yeah, it's in so many things.
Well, no, it's just... Well, I did it because I was like, all right, you're just going to eat less, Patrick. You can lose some weight. It's fine. Like, this will teach you to fast. And it did. But yeah, this was a long line. This sucks. I also have a box of Lucky Charms, just labeled Easter, sitting out on the counter. I can't wait for those now.
Nice. So you have to look at it every day?
Yep. Yep, I do.
Tough.
No, it's kind of getting me excited. I think that's all I had for this episode. This one was short, so we finally had a short one, so that was good.
Nice. Congratulations to ourselves.
Yeah, finally. No, seriously, like, it's so much nicer editing a short one than a long one. Oh my gosh. Okay, well, why don't we just leave it here then?
Okay. All right. Thanks, y'all.